please, my representative email.
Good morning, everyone. I'll call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Today's Tuesday, the 27th of January. We have three bills that we're going to take public hearing on. It appears that we do not have the paperwork to move anything through as into a work session, meaning fiscal impact or revenue impact.
Chair, we do have revenue impact statements for all of them, but not fiscal impact.
All right, so we need fiscals on all three, and then we'll be able to move them if that's the desire of the committee. If we can get the sign-up sheet for open up the... Well, first of all, I guess we're going to do a possible measure for introduction. We have LC 2677. Council, you want to give us an overview of what that is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. LC 2677 is a Measure 57 cleanup bill, and it's a pre-session... It's not a pre-session file, but we're filing it as a committee bill.
All right, thank you. And the Chair will take a motion for the introduction of LC 2677.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rutquist moves that we take LC 2677 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And now we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 243.
Would you like me to give an overview?
Yes.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 243 is from the Oregon State Bar Criminal Law Section. It applies provisions of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure 64F to motions in arrest of judgment in criminal actions. As we said before, we received a revenue statement. There's no revenue impact, but we do not have a fiscal statement yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. We have one person signed up at this point for giving testimony, Becky Duncan. Ms. Duncan? Good morning. If you'll state your name and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate that.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Becky Duncan. I'm an appellate attorney. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar's Criminal Law Section. Our Criminal Law Section represents the voluntary organization of members of the State Bar who are interested in criminal law issues. Our group has prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges alike. So when we come forward with legislation, it's because we believe that it would be supported by all criminal law practitioners, regardless of their role in the courtroom. I would like to explain what Senate Bill 243 does first, and then explain why we are asking you to pass it. Our belief is that this is a neutral housekeeping measure that fixes an unintended consequence of legislation that was passed in 2003. So as a bit of background, what this bill relates to is motions in arrest of judgment. Those are motions that are filed at the end of a criminal case. There's two types of motions that are filed at the end of criminal cases, commonly motions in arrest of judgment and motions for new trial. What Senate Bill 243 does is establish a deemed denied date for motions in arrest of judgment. And just to back up a little bit, prior to 2003, these two types of motions in criminal cases were treated the same. What happened was defendants had to file the motions within 5 days of the entry of judgment, and then the court had 20 days within which to rule on the motion. If the court didn't rule on the motion, it was deemed denied. So in other words, the court could do nothing, the motion would be deemed denied, and then the defendant would be in a position where he could file the notice of appeal. So that was how things worked prior to 2003. In 2003, there was a legislative change to make the timelines for these motions in criminal cases the same as the timelines for corresponding motions in civil cases. So the only thing that was intended to happen in 2003 was to change the dates. Specifically, like I mentioned, in criminal cases, you had to file your motion within 5 days, and then the court had to rule on it within 20 days. If they didn't, it was deemed denied. In civil cases, you had to file within 10 days, so a longer period, and the court had to rule on it within 55 days, so a longer period. So in 2003, there was an effort to make these timelines the same. What happened inadvertently was the deemed denied date for the motions in arrest of judgment was inadvertently deleted. And I'd like to just to make sure you completely understand what happened, just point to points in my written testimony so that you can understand what happened in 2003. On the middle of page 2, the law as it existed before 2003 is set out. That law was ORS 136535. And you'll see the numbered sections, subsections 1, 2, 3, and 4 are set out in the middle of the page. And you'll see sections 1, 2, and 3 set out the timelines. So it was 5 days to file your motion. The court had to act on it within 20 days. If they didn't, it was deemed denied. Well, in 2003, what the legislature did was delete sections 1, 2, and 3, so delete the timeline sections. And the reason they did that was because they wanted to rely solely on subsection 4, which is a cross-reference to the civil rules of procedure. So they referenced ORCP 64, A, B, and D through G. The important one in there is OR 64F. That's the civil timelines of 10 days and 55 days. So the intent was to make the timelines the same for the criminal and the civil cases. The glitch was that the referenced civil rule of procedure 64F only mentions motions for new trial. It doesn't mention motions in arrest of judgment. And so there were all of a sudden no deemed denied dates for motions in arrest of judgment. And what has happened is the Court of Appeals in 2007 said, well, that legislative change kind of decoupled, eliminated the deemed denied date for motions in arrest of judgment. So now, whereas before, if the court did nothing, the motion was denied and the defendant could begin his appeal, now the court has to issue a written order and there's no timeline for the court to do that. And what to illustrate what that means, I'd like to refer to State versus Starr. That's a case where the defendant made a motion in arrest of judgment. The trial court denied it orally on the record, but didn't issue a written order. The defendant thought that the oral denial was sufficient to complete the trial court case, file the notice of appeal. The Court of Appeals said that the notice was premature, too early, and so the defendant's appeal was dismissed. And then the defendant appealed again, saying, well, the motion was deemed denied because the 55 days had passed, and the Court of Appeals said, no, there's no longer a deemed denied date. So the reason we would like the legislature to clarify the law to reinstate the deemed denied date is because it never intended to delete it in the first place. And the goal that the legislature had was to create uniform timelines and procedures for all of these post-trial motions in criminal and civil cases. And now we have, for this one type of motion, an anomalous procedure. And it does two things. Does three things. It creates confusion because there's an inconsistent practice. It causes delay because trial courts don't know that they have to issue a written order. It causes unnecessary paperwork because instead of just simply being able to let the time pass, the trial court actually has to enter the written order. And it means that these cases can linger in the trial court because there's no fixed time within which the trial court has to decide these motions. So that is what has happened and why we would ask this committee to recommend approval of Senate Bill 243. I'd be happy to take any questions if the committee has them.
Ms. Duncan, thank you very much. Let me first ask, if you said this at the beginning, I didn't catch it. Are you working with the Department of Justice?
No, I do not. I work with the Office of Public Defense Services. I handle criminal appeals, but I'm here on behalf of the State Bar's Criminal Law Section.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking at who's in the audience here, and I saw only you being signed up, so I wasn't sure in what capacity you're coming in at. Any questions for Ms. Duncan? Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Duncan, I'm just curious about why, if this happened in 2003, did it take so long to come to the attention of the legislature? Or maybe it was brought up in previous sessions, I don't know.
Well, timing-wise, what's really prompting this bill, Senator Bonamici, is the 2007 case, which came out in January 2007, which was too late for filing a bill for that session, and that didn't rise to the priorities to file it in the short session in 2008.
Thank you.
It seems like the court kind of gives us, let's say, additional work as the sessions move forward, once we hear a decision or two. And it's not uncommon for us to actually be taking up cases. I know that there are, or let's say results of cases, and I know that there will be a few more this session as well. Your presentation is thorough. Thank you very much. And if there are any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give any testimony today on Senate Bill 243? Not seeing anyone running up to the podium. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 243, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 242. Council, why don't you give us an overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 242 is also from the Oregon State Bar Criminal Law Section. It prescribes an express procedural mechanism for proof and stipulation of previous convictions. As we stated before, there is no revenue impact, and we do not have a fiscal statement yet.
All right, thank you. Looks like we're sharing the workload here. Tim Sylvester. Morning, Tim.
Good morning. We have some written testimony also be submitted. Tim Sylvester, I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice in the Appellate Division, but this morning I'm appearing on behalf of the Criminal Law Section. As Becky Duncan described, the Criminal Law Section, the Executive Board, is composed of defense counsel and prosecutors and occasionally judges. We came up with a couple of proposals this year that are intended to be neutral, even-handed law improvement projects that everybody agrees with, and this is one that all members of the committee agreed with, and we passed by the ODAA and the OCDLA and judicial. And the basic purpose, the purpose of this bill is, over the last few legislative sessions, we have had, the legislature has enacted a growing list of crimes for which the fact of a previous conviction elevates the seriousness of the offense. For example, moving it from a misdemeanor to a felony offense. That is, for example, the case in assault 4. If the defendant has a previous conviction for a comparable offense, it moves from a Class A misdemeanor to a felony. Another example that everybody knows about is felony driving while under the influence of intoxicants. So anyway, we've had several of these new crimes created, and the problem that we're having is dealing with how do we allege, prove, and prove the prior conviction element. The current statutory scheme is a bit ambiguous with respect to how it is to be alleged in the indictment. A case came out at the Court of Appeals a few years ago called State versus Reynolds that said that if it's a prior conviction that is used to elevate the offense from a misdemeanor to a felony, it needs to be alleged in the indictment. Then the question becomes, how do we prove these? And for in the case of felony driving under the influence of intoxicants and aggravated murder, there is a special statute already enacted in the code that provides a mechanism for the pretrial stipulation of a previous conviction. What this bill does is it uses that as a model and makes it applicable to all of these prior conviction crimes. A few years ago, this issue came up before the Oregon Supreme Court in a case called State versus Hess, in which the issue was, if you have a prior conviction offense like felony assault 4, may the defendant stipulate to the fact of the prior conviction, and so that prior conviction is taken away from the jury's consideration at trial. From the defendant's standpoint, they want to not have the jury be aware of the prior conviction. And from the prosecution standpoint, it's an element of the offense that we have to prove, and we want to make sure that it's done properly. Well, the Supreme Court came out with a decision that said in that particular case, if there's an adequate stipulation, it may be removed from the jury's consideration and be considered at sentencing. And so the court essentially adopted by court decision what is the practice in the statutes already for felony driving under the influence of intoxicants, but there is no statutory scheme for the rest of them. And so the purpose of this bill is essentially to codify what the Supreme Court did in Hess, and to codify what the Oregon Court of Appeals did in Reynolds, and to provide a specific mechanism set out in statute for dealing with this. And I'll explain. The first section of the bill, what it does is it makes clear that if you have one of these prior conviction offenses, and then what it would be the new language in subsection 3, it constitutes a material element of the charged offense, then it shall be alleged in the indictment. So that essentially codifies Reynolds. If you have a prior conviction sort of offense, the state has to allege the prior conviction in the indictment. Section 2 of the bill sets up the procedure by which a defendant may stipulate to the fact of the prior conviction and in some circumstances take the prior conviction fact away from the jury's consideration at trial. And so it provides subsection 1 of the bill, subsection 1 of section 2 provides the minimum necessary stipulation. Subsection 2 of that section provides what happens if the court accepts the stipulation. Section 3 and then section 4 allow under some circumstances the state to present evidence of the prior conviction if it is otherwise relevant to the offense. Finally, in subsection 3, in section 3 of the bill, what this does is there have been a number of decisions by the Oregon Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals over the past few years that deal with the situation where a defendant is charged with a prior conviction offense and he or she wants to challenge the validity or existence of that offense. Say, that wasn't me, that wasn't my conviction. Okay, yes, I was convicted of that, but that conviction is invalid, legally invalid, and should not be offered against me. And so what this, and typically what that is done by a pretrial posture. Right now we don't have a set statutory scheme for dealing with those what we call collateral challenges to the existence and validity of a prior conviction. What Section 3 of this bill does is it attempts to codify a decision by the Oregon Supreme Court called Probst, in which the State versus Probst, in which the court set out a mechanism for doing that. And what that requires is that if a defendant is charged with a prior conviction offense, such as assault in the fourth degree as a felony because of a prior conviction for a similar offense, and he or she wants to, and so the indictment has alleged it, defendant wants to challenge the validity or existence of that conviction, the defendant must file a notice prior to trial identifying which conviction he or she wants to challenge and the reason for that challenge, and then the court is directed to hold a pretrial hearing for that purpose. And I want to pause just for a second and say the reason we want to do it in a pretrial hearing is because if there's an adverse ruling, the court says the conviction is invalid, we want to preserve the state's right to appeal from such a ruling. And so that is put in statute here. But anyway, at the hearing, the state bears the burden of proof that the prior conviction does exist. It's by a preponderance of the evidence. And then if the state carries that burden, then the burden shifts to the defendant to prove that the conviction is invalid. And the statute sets out in subsection 5 or section 3 when those circumstances in which a previous conviction is not valid, and that is those two, paragraph A and paragraph B, are consistent with current law as to when a prior conviction is invalid for these purposes. And so the statute thereby sets out a process for that to be done. Again, the basic purpose of this is simply not to change existing law, but to set up a specific procedure in statute that the practitioners may follow, that the court may follow, so that we can properly plead prior conviction elements, we can provide a mechanism for stipulating to them if defendant wants to and how that stipulation works, and if a defendant chooses to challenge the validity or existence of that prior conviction, we have a set process set out in statutes that are applicable to all of these offenses for doing that. Now, I do want to point out that in the last couple of days, we have been in negotiations passing this by the ODAA, Oregon District Attorneys Association, representatives of the ODAA, representatives of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the OCDLA, and the Judicial Department. And each of them had a little tweak in the bill that they wanted to change. And as of this morning, I think we're all in agreement with three minor changes, and I will point them out to the committee. The first one is in Section 1 of the bill, subsection 3, where it says constitutes a material element of the offense or subjects a defendant to a mandatory minimum sentence that is not otherwise prescribed for the charged offense. The prosecutors have an objection to B because there is not current case law that requires that such a fact be alleged in the indictment as opposed to a pretrial pleading under Senate Bill 528. And I have to agree that that is true, that paragraph B is not now required by law, and it may end up creating problems for us. And it may end up, too, also being redundant with the material element of charge defense set out in paragraph A. Anyway, as I understand it, the OCDLA does not have any problem with deleting paragraph B and just having subsection 3 read, when the previous conviction constitutes a material element of charge defense. Moving along on section 3, there are two problems. Or two things that we would like to do. First, the OCDLA has pointed out that this bill is a little bit unclear. When you go through a pretrial process and the court determines that the prior conviction is valid and that that exists and the defendant failed to prove that it is invalid, is the defendant still entitled to a jury trial on the existence of the prior conviction? And my thought is, well, of course he is, because it's an element of defense, but it doesn't set that out in the statute. And so what we're proposing is a minor change to subsection 4 of section 3 that essentially would provide, and I could provide copies of the draft to the committee. Subsection 4 would then provide, if the previous if the court determines that the defendant previously was convicted of the offense and that the conviction is valid, or if the defendant does not file and serve a notice under subsection 1 of this section, the previous conviction shall be admitted at trial or during the sentencing proceeding. If the previous conviction is admitted, the defendant may dispute whether the defendant previously was convicted of the alleged offense, but may not challenge the validity of the conviction. This is the crucial language. If the previous conviction is a material element of the charged offense or a sentence enhancement fact, the state must prove the previous conviction beyond a reasonable doubt unless the defendant stipulates to the fact in accordance with Section 2 of this Act. And so that additional language will simply make clear that if the court in the pretrial hearing determines that the conviction exists and is valid, then it will be admissible at trial, and the state has to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury. The final minor change is at the request of the Judicial Department, and it relates to some language in Section 3, Subsection 1C. What it now provides is that in order to challenge the prior conviction, the defendant must file a notice, and it says, be filed with the court and served on the district attorney at least 7 days prior to the first day set for trial. And evidently, the 7 days prior to the date set for trial presents a problem in some small counties. And the Oregon Judicial Department has proposed some alternative language for us, and I'm indifferent to it, whether it's 7 days or language presented by the Judicial Department. I think the idea is that the notice has to be provided to the prosecutor and the court prior to trial in some in time that will allow for the pretrial hearing to occur and the state to marshal its evidence. And we've been in negotiations with the Judicial Department this morning, tweaking the exact language that will be happening, and with the representatives of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, in order to get some language that will be helpful, that will serve that purpose. Anyway, what I would like to do, if the committee is willing, is to have submit some those three modifications to the Legislative Council and have the bill amended for that purpose. That's the end of my testimony this morning. If any members of the committee have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Right, before we do questions, Tim, I agree. That sounds to me that the interested parties need to continue to work, polish out whatever the language is, work with counsel. I guess Josh would probably be the person at LC that you're probably working on this.
Yeah, that's probably right.
All right, and then get that submitted, and then we can bring it back, understanding that we have some tweaking to be done. I'm going to open it up for questions now and see if anyone has any questions. I've got one I just wanted to walk through. I think this is more to be put on the record if we could. And this is basically when you have a stipulation under Section 2 that has been tendered by the defendant, and it comes to the judge, and the judge finds it to be acceptable and meet all the criteria that's necessary. I understand that there's a desire to not have that stipulation be known to the defendant or to the jury unless and except in specific situations. And my understanding is that basically if you have a statute that defines a charging offense to require that as an element, then that would be submitted to the jury so they would be able to have all the facts that they would need to determine whether or not the person is guilty of the new charge.
Chairman Brzezinski, members of the committee, there are two situations. Some statutes, the fact of a prior conviction is what you might call an integral part of the statute of the offense, such that if you don't have that element, the conduct is not a crime. And a good example of that is felon in possession of a firearm. If you take out the felony conviction, all he'd be charged with is being in possession of a firearm. And we didn't want, in those situations, the fact of the prior conviction to be taken away from the jury because you'd be asking the jury to decide whether the defendant possessed a firearm, and everybody going, what's wrong with possessing a firearm? And so when the fact of a prior conviction is a material, integral element of the offense such that the conduct would not be a crime without the fact of the prior conviction, then that is a circumstance in which the prior conviction would be admitted to the jury regardless of the stipulation. But in those circumstances where the underlying offense is an offense already, say assault in the fourth degree, and the fact of the prior conviction is simply an element that elevates the offense to a greater offense, to from assault for misdemeanor to assault for felony, then under the decision in Hess, the fact that if there's an adequate stipulation to the prior conviction, then that is a circumstance in which it may be taken away from the jury's consideration. And that's the distinction that's established in this statute.
Yeah, and again, for setting the record, so basically what we're saying, if the prior conviction is going to enhance the sentence, and it's not something that the jury really has to determine as to the new charge that's been filed, whether they violated that, that would stay with the court. The court at the time after the jury came back, if it came back with a guilty verdict, mm-hmm. then would take that in consideration for sentencing purposes.
Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, yes, that's correct. And so that's the dichotomy that's drawn out in the statute. And the other thing I do want to point out is if the prior conviction is stipulated to and taken away from the jury's consideration, if during the course of the trial the fact of the prior conviction becomes independently relevant for some other purpose, for example, the defendant takes a stand and testifies in his own defense, the state may impeach his testimony with the fact of the prior conviction because in that situation the prior conviction is being offered as impeachment, not to prove the prior conviction element.
Great. Thank you for putting that on the record. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 242? And if not, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 242. That one will come back once we have the paperwork back from LC. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 266.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 266 states that for purposes of complying with the statute of limitations, an action is commenced when the complaint is filed. This comes from the Oregon State Bar Practices and Procedures Committee. And we don't have a fiscal impact statement. We do have a no revenue impact statement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Looks like we have two individuals that are going to give testimony today. Courtney, is it Dimple?
Dimple, yeah.
Dimple, okay. And then also Martha Pellegrino. And Martha, why don't you go ahead and come on up? Thank you. And Courtney, since you're a proponent for this, please let's say register by giving us your name and give us your testimony, please.
Is somebody against this?
Good morning, Chair Brzezanski, members of the committee. My name is Courtney Diffel. I've been a lawyer since 2002 in private practice. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar, and I appear today on behalf of the State Bar's Procedure and Practice Committee to speak in support of Senate Bill 266. Our committee is composed of one trial court judge and 16 attorneys from throughout the state. We maintain a balance of both plaintiff's lawyers and defense lawyers and attempt to get a consensus on each issue that we consider. We are charged with assessing the practical impact proposed laws will have on the day-to-day workings of our civil judicial system. We are proud to have acted as an objective resource to the legislature's Judiciary Committee in this respect for many years. From time to time, our committee proposes bills on our own to clarify or correct the rules governing the operation of our legal system. That is the case of Senate Bill 266, which our committee has proposed in order to clarify the date on which a legal action is commenced in order to meet the timeline of the statute of limitations. In order to determine when the time required, whether a legal action is filed within the time required by the statute of limitations, there are two different sets of rules that are at play. One, Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure 3, and ORS 12.020. Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure 3, or what I'll commonly refer to as ORCP 3, provides the date upon which an action is commenced for the purposes of trial court calendaring, procedural deadlines, and case management. ORS 12.020 sets forth the date upon which an action is deemed commenced solely for purposes of the statute of limitations. ORS 12.020, as currently written, is confusing because of its overlap with ORCP 3. ORCP 3 states that an action is commenced by filing a complaint with the clerk of the court, except for purposes of statutes of limitations. So in order for lawyers to determine how to meet the statute of limitations, members or attorneys must refer to ORS 12.020. Now, ORS 12.020 states that in order for an action to be commenced within the applicable statute of limitations, the complaint must be properly served on all defendants within 60 days after filing with the court. What's happened is that people have read ORCP 3 incorrectly, and they interpret the rule to mean that once they file the complaint within the statute of limitations, that's sufficient, not realizing that if service isn't accomplished on all defendants within 60 days, the statute of limitations hasn't actually been satisfied. So what we're here to do is to Senate Bill 266 solves the problem in a simple matter. What it does is it amends ORS 12.020 to make the suit commenced on the date that the complaint is filed with no reference as to when the complaint must be served. Now, this does not change the requirement that a complaint be served within a reasonable time. Right now, the current uniform trial court rules, or what we like to refer to as the UTCRs, require that a plaintiff have the defendant served within a specified number of days. And if that timeline isn't met, the complaint will be dismissed for want of prosecution. So amending ORS 12.020 resolves any confusion or ambiguity between ORCP 3 and ORS 12.020 for the purposes of statute of limitations. Now, this morning when I walked in, I learned that the city of Portland has some concerns with Senate Bill 266 as currently specified, and they want some clarity as to when a defendant must be served. So what we would like to do is to amend the Senate bill as currently written to address those concerns as to when defendants must be served. So I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions, committee? Thank you, Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino, representing the City of Portland. I have distributed a letter from Harry Auerbach, who is the Chief Deputy City Attorney in charge of the city's litigation practice, and that letter outlines a couple of concerns with Senate Bill 266. As Ms. Dibble reviewed, essentially what this bill does is delete the requirement that a defendant need to be served within 60 days, which is under the current law, and that is the second requirement when a requirement for a action being commenced. And I think essentially the concern is that defendants, whether they be public bodies or private bodies, need time to prepare a competent defense, and that the statute is written provides that, ensuring that within 60 days the defendant receives service of the complaint. And we would be very happy to work with the bar and work with this committee on addressing those issues. But I think that the issue is that defendants need to make sure they know when a suit is commenced.
All right. I've got a couple of questions. Let me see if anyone else on the committee has any questions at this point. So in a public setting, the Tort Claim Act, if it's a tort, would require notice to be served. Is it 120 days or 180 days?
Yes. I think it's 120.
120 is what I think.
I believe it's 120.
Okay. So once that notice is filed, then that would put the public entity on notice that there's potentially going to be a lawsuit that could be filed depending on what, I guess, transactions occur after that notice has been filed. So, and Martha, if you could walk us through, my understanding is that what this is basically saying is that they would meet the elements of statute of limitation as to having it filed, the case filed with the clerk, still needing a reasonable period of time to actually serve the defendants. And the concern that the City of Portland has raised is that that 60 days is not sufficient time to be, let's say, prepared to go forward.
Mr. Chair, the actual 60-day requirement would be deleted in this bill.
Right.
So that there really isn't a then set number of days, if this were deleted, in order to provide the city with timely service of that complaint. I think, as Ms. Dibble mentioned, it would then default to court rules as opposed to the statute.
Okay. So timely service, and the concern that what I'm hearing is the city wants to make certain that it's served relatively sooner than later?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And it's my understanding that currently, with the 60-day rule, if someone is not served within the 60 days, then who would be moving for dismissing for want of prosecution? Because I would assume at that point the defendant wouldn't know that they potentially been sued.
Chair Brzezinski, that is correct. What currently happens is that if a plaintiff hasn't filed a proof of service on the defendant within 63 days of filing, under Uniform Trial Court Rule 7.020, often the court will issue an automatic notice of dismissal. That if a plaintiff hasn't filed a proof of service within a specified number of days, the court will on its own behalf dismiss the suit. Now, what can happen is that a defendant could be served outside of the 60 days. They get notice of the suit, and then they could, in their first response to the complaint, move for inappropriate service or insufficient service of process. What Senate Bill 266 is designed to do is just to simply clarify when an action is commenced for purposes of statutes of limitations, because that is a separate issue as to when service must be effectuated. And I think what the city wants to do is they want a statutory reference as to when service must be accomplished by. And so we are happy to work with the city to address that concern, and we would take the position that that is separate as to when the statute of limit, as to when a complaint is commenced for purposes of the statute of limitations.
Okay.
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like some clarity from either of you about why the Uniform Trial Court Rule requirement is not sufficient to address the concern that the city has about service.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, and my disclaimer is that since I'm not a chief litigation attorney, I'm doing my best to stand in his shoes today. But the issue is that trial court rule is at the discretion of the court, and that the courts can determine what those rules are. The way that this statute is currently written, there are two requirements in statute that then ensure that the defendant is given proper notice. But obviously it's this body that has the jurisdiction over changing the statute, and there are currently two requirements. I think we're comfortable with those. In this, actually, second page of a letter submitted by Mr. Auerbach, there is a sort of a, I guess I would consider sort of an alternate solution that could also address the issue of timely service. But what I would encourage this committee not to do is just completely delete the requirement that's in the statute that that details when the action is commenced.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I want to come back because it seems to me that a plaintiff would acting in good faith is going to get the defendant served as quickly as possible. And when you're talking about a public entity, it would seem to me that if they delayed this beyond 60 days or whatever, the court's going to take that into consideration as to whether or not they have, let's say, fulfilled their obligations in serving a person in a reasonable period of time instead of delays. Since I don't do civil work, if you have a case that's filed and the plaintiff has tried to locate the defendant and has been unsuccessful in doing so under the current law of 60 days, what steps can the plaintiff take to preserve their case while they're trying to find the defendant, if anything?
Chair Posansky and members of the committee, I'm not exactly sure what steps they can take if it's outside of the 60-day period. I can look into that and get and report back to the committee.
Just curious, yeah. I mean, in criminal, of course, we just ask the judge for a warrant. That kind of stays everything. So, all right, any other questions? All right, thank you very much. So we're going to understand at this point that you're going to work together to try to come to some agreement and get amendments drafted, and then we will review those and decide whether or not we want to accept those amendments or not. So let me ask if there's anyone else that wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 266. Not seeing anyone here, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 266. And Council, anything else we need to cover today?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right, so thank you, everyone. I assume we're on for 8:30 tomorrow?
Yes, that's correct.
And so we'll close the public hearings and the work on the, and the session for the committee today, and we'll return tomorrow.